WILL 580 AM and 90.9 FM HD3, Urbana.
This is Keeping the Faith, a weekly discussion about issues of faith, spirituality, religion, and ethics. Now here's your host, Steve Shoemaker.
We're talking today about homelessness with University of Illinois PhD graduate student Abby Harmon. Welcome, Abby.
Hi. Thank you, Steve.
Good to have you here in the studio. You've been very active in being involved of supporting people who are homeless in the Champaign-Urbana community. While you've been a graduate student, how did you get interested in all of this?
How I got interested actually didn't have to do with meeting anyone or, having an experience. I read a book that was written in 2003.
Good thing for a student to do.
I know. And it was about the criminalization of homelessness and particularly, how there's been a rash over the last 20 years of city governments putting city ordinances in place, things like that, that keep people out of public spaces.
What was the book you read?
It's by Don Mitchell, called The Right to the City.
Huh.
And, he's really masterful. And it just, it enraged me when I read it. And I thought, it's really terrible that there are so many people out there experiencing homelessness and with no real options, and that this is the way we would choose to react to that.
Now, you've been teaching a seminar class where other graduate students, undergrads, you can tell me who mainly is in it, but get involved in the issue and actually learn about it and try to do something positive. Tell us about that.
Yeah, well, when I started my PhD, I got involved with the East St. Louis Action Research Project, and they taught this course. It was run through them, and I had the opportunity to begin teaching this a year after I started with the program. It made perfect sense to me because my scholarship was so melded with activism that I also continue to do that for undergraduate students. And so I began working with a shelter provider, and I quickly became able to have them work with the Safe Haven tent community. But the whole idea behind the course is that students don't get a lot of chances to interact with their community, particularly those in the community who are more isolated, like the homeless. And so I think it gives them an opportunity that they just won't find elsewhere.
For listeners who may not have known about the East St. Louis project, tell us about that.
Sure. It's about 22 years in running now, and it began out of a plea from a representative that was from East St. Louis. She wrote to the University of Illinois and said, "It's really a shame that you all are not working in the most impoverished community in your state, being the land-grant institution." And so architecture, landscape architecture, and urban planning professors began going down there because a lot of the needs that they had were physical at that time. The whole area had been really decimated. And so over time, we've brought in different units, but the idea was always to be working on issues of poverty and social justice. And this class has been in Champaign-Urbana for the last 2 years because the project has been recognizing that we also need to be doing this in our own community.
Locally.
Mm-hmm.
And other listeners may not have heard about the Safe Haven tent community.
Sure. There's a lot that I could say about it.
Yes, there is.
I became very involved with the group of people that started Safe Haven tent community. And I think there are a lot of misconceptions around what Safe Haven Tent Community was and what they were about. This was a group of 10, 12 individuals that were not able to access the shelters. Some of them had been banned from the shelters for various reasons. Others were in couples. And as our listeners may or may not know, we do not have shelter for families or couples in town. And so people are forced to split up if they want to seek that. And so this group, for various reasons, was on the street, so to speak. And they began camping together out of a need for safety. oftentimes people sleeping on the street are jumped for their belongings or for various reasons.
On All Things Considered, we just heard a report of that in New Delhi in India.
Really?
Yeah. Street kids who are beaten up and stuff, their stuff stolen that they might have earned by bigger kids and,
right,
and adults and so on.
Right.
But it happens right here.
Sure. Yeah. It happens everywhere. I mean, when you're on the street, it's very much rule by might. And this group of people was tired of that. They didn't want to be subjected to that. So they began camping together out of safety. And I think a group consciousness formed very early on. They called me about 3 weeks after they'd come together. I was known for having done some research on tent cities and other areas. And so they thought that I could be helpful with what they wanted to do. But the group really just wanted to house themselves in the best way that they could.
We'll get back to talking a little bit more in detail about that, but let me encourage listeners to join this conversation. This is a live program every Sunday night here on WILL AM 580. And if you'd like to talk with our guest, Abby Harmon, do give us a call. The number in Champaign-Urbana is 333-9455. If it's a long-distance call for you, you may call toll-free 1-800-222-9455. And that's true of people listening on the Internet, perhaps quite far away. You may use that toll-free number, 1-800-222-9455. Abby, tell us a little bit about your academic background that got you to this place as a PhD student, learning about the homeless and trying to help them.
I did my undergraduate degree in Lexington at the University of Kentucky, and I came up here to Champaign-Urbana to do my master's in communication. At that time, I was very interested in how media frames things, you know, some of those issues. Issues of rhetoric, really, how people talk about things. And I started studying how people talk about homelessness, which is what led me to this book about the criminalization of homelessness. And that background served me well. It's helped me, you know, gain an understanding of how people discuss things and how that really changes how they might react to them or make policy. But I wanted more concrete ways to get involved. And so I thought that planning and landscape architecture, I mean, they're very concrete. They are in space. Everything that's happening is in space. And so I moved into that degree program in landscape architecture and urban planning with the hopes that I would gain some tools to be able to understand the problem of homelessness better and promote solutions to it.
Some listeners may not have any idea that you could get an advanced degree at the University of Illinois and actually be involved in something as practical as trying to find places for people to live.
Yeah. I mean, I've carried this idea that activism and scholarship can be one and the same thing, or that they can exist together. And, I mean, landscape architecture is such a concrete program that when you look at research in landscape, I mean, what you're talking about is what people do in space and how you can do it better.
Now, tell us why you care about that. What drives you? What motivates you? Why do you want to be an activist as well as get a PhD?
Well, I think that if you do research, you know more about something at a very basic level. And a friend asked me this a few years ago, and the answer that I gave to her that has really stuck with me is, I want to understand social inequality as much as I can to decrease it as much as I can in this lifetime. And that's very simply my philosophy towards scholarship and activism.
And moral, that kind of social inequality, that's kind of a moral concern. What's your background? Do you have a religious background? Do you have a secular background? Where did this come from?
I do not have a religious background. You know, we attended church when I was young, but that ended early on. What I do think influenced me greatly was that growing up, there was never bias stated in my household. towards any particular groups of people. There was never even a sense that there were different groups of people. And I think that just that openness, that sort of blank slate approach to people, spoke volumes in the fact that it didn't say much, if that makes sense.
Why do you think your family of origin was so unbiased? Because that's kind of unusual.
Yeah.
Not only in America, around the world.
Well, my dad was raised in the Amish community. And I say raised in the Amish community because you don't actually become Amish until you join. But I think he saw a lot of judgment in that community and a lot of straining to fit in and sort of sectioning off of people. And I think that he never wanted that to be the case in the life that he led and the children that he raised.
Do you have brothers and sisters?
I have three older brothers.
What do they do?
Two of them are engineers, and one is a drywall contractor, like my dad.
Huh. So you're following this academic path. Is that something they can understand, appreciate?
As some of them can. The oldest had a harder trek ahead of him. I mean, he was forced to go into drywall contracting. Uh-huh. And so I think the opportunities and the privilege that I've had to be able to seek higher education, he did not have access to those. So we don't see as eye to eye, but the other two I think are pretty happy with what I'm doing.
And what kind of a struggle have you had as the daughter of a drywall contractor to go as far as to get a PhD at the University of Illinois? Where have you gotten the money to do that?
I can honestly say I haven't had to overcome a lot of obstacles. My mom stayed home with all of us and worked with all of us. I mean, we were all ahead in our classes because she worked so diligently on our education at home. Mm-hmm. And that led to scholarships for my brothers and myself. And so I've worked, definitely, but lots of people work really hard. And I've been able to have the privilege and the opportunity that when I worked hard, it paid off.
Did you grow up in Kentucky?
No, I grew up in West Virginia.
Okay.
My parents were pseudo-hippie-ish, you could say. The 1970s, you know, this back-to-the-land movement. Of course, they didn't know they were part of it at the time, but they moved from Pennsylvania and to get out of the rat race. So we were raised in very rural West Virginia.
But you got a scholarship to go to University of Kentucky?
I did, yes.
Out-of-state student? Wow.
Yeah. Yeah, I was really fortunate to get a full scholarship down there, and so I didn't have to do the grind that a lot of people that I knew did of working their way through.
And what about grad school? You get assistantships,
yes.
That sort of thing?
Yeah. I've taught for the last 5 years, and that provides a way to make a living while you're in school.
So let me get a picture of your life as a graduate student. You're teaching a class, or more than one. You're taking courses yourself. You're eventually writing a dissertation, doing research. And then you're also finding time to be an activist with some of the poorest people in the local community and in East St. Louis, in the state. Tell me how you balance that. How do you find the time?
Well, you make it sound kind of impossible, but it is possible. The way that I find time is if I had to just do school, I would not still be here. I don't think that if I had not been able to make my scholarship fit with what I wanted to do in the community, I wouldn't have been interested in continuing with the research. So I guess that's to say that certain things bring you energy and certain things take energy away, and the activism brings the energy, and that's how it happens.
We're talking with Abby Harmon, a graduate student at the University of Illinois, about homelessness. If you'd like to join the conversation, let me give the numbers once again, 333-9455 in Champaign-Urbana, elsewhere 1-800-222-9455. I'm Steve Shoemaker, the usual host for these Keeping the Faith programs, and I'm happy to ask questions, but I'm also happy to have other people join in. Abby, talk a little bit about what you first discovered when you started to learn about the homeless in Champaign-Urbana.
Well, my first real interaction with people experiencing homelessness was a four-week observation I did up at the Time Center, which is the local men's shelter. And up there, I had the opportunity, because I wasn't in a volunteer situation, I was there observing for a course. And the staff there and the director were nice enough to let me come and do that. Because I wasn't in that weird volunteer position, I was able to meet a lot of people, and that was my real side goal, if you will, beyond the observation. What I found was that homeless people are, well, the phrase homeless people, people are only homeless for a certain period of time in their life. And oftentimes that one period of their lives ends up defining the bulk of their life. Formerly homeless, still bear that title. And there's a lot of shame that comes with it. I mean, people have a hard time overcoming just the stigma that's placed on them.
And what did that motivate you to do?
To start learning more and to take some small actions in ways that I could. For instance, one of the things that came out of talking to the men up at the Time Center was that for various reasons and various times, they had been targeted by police in different communities, not just Champaign-Urbana. But one of the things we did was to conduct small surveys to find out, you know, the major things that were happening to people and put together, you know, some strategies to deal with that. And I met some law students that do a Know Your Rights with the police. And so we worked with them. That was one of the earliest things that we worked on. But really, I guess my approach to working with people in homelessness and working on the issues is just that, you know, as things arise, we figure out how we can work on them together and try to get something done.
Let's jump to the present situation in Champaign-Urbana, and I know there are differences between the two cities' approach to people who are homeless, and the various city councils have responded differently in the past. There are different services provided, but what is the current situation for someone who's homeless in Champaign-Urbana today?
Well, it's somewhat difficult to say. I mean, we can't get really good numbers on who is experiencing homelessness.
Very hard to count.
It's very hard to count. I mean, especially with some changes to the definition. Now we're talking about people who are doubled up. There's just simply no way to count the people that are in those situations. But we have recognized that there are some gaps in the shelter services that we have. Specifically, like I mentioned before, we do not have any shelters for families. So this is with kids or just couples. And that creates a real problem. I mean, if you can't have the person or people that you love next to you as you're experiencing this really traumatic time, that's a real decrease in the support system you have available. But some of the other gaps that we have, we've never had shelter in this town that is targeted specifically to people with mental illness or severe substance abuse. And because of that, we have temporary detox centers like the Prairie Center. But there's no real way to handle mental illness and substance abuse when they're in advanced stages with the existing shelters that we have.
And you've talked about the issue of families, but also people who are mentally ill, for example, may not be willing to be in a shelter, even the shelters that exist, because of perhaps their schizophrenia that makes them afraid to be very close to people and they don't want to be touched or what, all of those kind of issues. They may be talking to themselves. They may be hearing voices. The mentally ill are sort of a separate but very large category of people who are homeless.
Well, one of the things, and if you read in the paper last week, the article about looking for a place for families.
I did, yes.
A report that our students put together over this past semester is quoted in there. What is not quoted in the paper is that this report was actually in three sections, only one of them dealing with families. The other two sections were looking at permanent supportive housing for individuals. But this other one, and the one that I want to talk about a little bit, is a program called Housing First, or Safe Havens, they're also called, no relation to the Safe Haven tent community. But these are specifically for people with severe mental illness and possibly substance abuse. Because of all those issues that you just talked about, in shelters, people who are paranoid schizophrenic do not want to be in an enclosed space with a lot of other people. And these Safe Haven or Housing First programs are set up specifically to be safe spaces for people who do have mental issues. And we were promoting, of course, the development of a program like that here in town.
And in a time when we're reminded almost every minute that there's not enough money anywhere in society, in the nation, in the state, in the county, in the cities, where does response come from? Where do you get any money to help meet the needs of real people who are suffering?
Well, you're right. There is not a lot of money right now. It's difficult to say where you get money from. I mean, the federal government has increasingly backed off of their responsibility since they started providing money in the 80s. And communities, you know, we have a lot of things that we need to get done. I mean, the city of Champaign has said they need to cut their budget by millions of dollars. One idea that has been brewing, John Sullivan is the director of the Center for Women in Transition. He has talked about this idea of a tax levy for housing, and specifically for low-income housing, which, of course, you know, if people are homeless, they are often falling into low or very low or extremely low income. And the idea, of course, it's not fleshed out, but the idea of using a tax levy for housing or for shelter services, that could really fill in a gap with, you know, not a lot of money coming from each of the citizens in the community, but put together, we could really make a dent in the housing problem that we have here.
And at least in the state of Illinois, there's some evidence from the last actions of the state government legislatures that when it becomes very obvious that the taxes need to be raised some, it can happen. It's very difficult to have happen, but it can happen. What do you see locally that practically could happen? I know from the article in the paper last week about a place for families, there was some talk about using some United Way money.
Right. I think practically right now, I think that there is political will in the community for an emergency family shelter. And it makes sense why. I mean, families, anytime children are involved, you can see much more clearly that these kids cannot be on the street. Adults can survive in unsavory situations, but I think that most people would say kids need to be in a safe place. And so for that reason, I think that there is some political will to get this done. The Council of Service Providers to the Homeless is seriously talking about this. They've taken the report that the students did, and they're doing further work to look at some closer to home instances where people are opening these emergency shelters. I think that it could be done with the combining of community resources.
Tell us about the Homelessness Marathon.
The Homelessness Marathon, for those of you who have not listened to it, it is a really radical program, 14 hours long, begins at 6 p.m. and runs until 8 a.m. This year it's going to be on February 23rd, and so it will start at 6 p.m. That evening. And this program devotes 14 hours to relatively unstructured people who are experiencing homelessness right now can come on the show and talk about their experiences. And the 14 hours is very daunting. Nobody can listen to it for that long.
And this radio show can be heard where?
On WEFT.
WEFT?
Yes.
What are the numbers for
90.1,
that?
90.1, correct. And yes, so this program is run by a really wonderful person, Jeremy Alderson. He brought me on a few years ago to produce the show, and I've remained involved in a less intense role since then. But I just think it's a really fantastic time that, you know, what I hear from so many people who have only thought a little bit about homelessness or don't really know what to think. The reason why most of them don't know what to think about it is that they've never talked to somebody who's homeless. They've never actually sat down and said, what's going on? You know, tell me about your experience. And so this is 14 hours of a chance to just tune in and hear some of the reasons, the real reasons why people become homeless.
And again, that's February 23rd on WEFT. That's an FM station locally. Also a public station, 90.1 on your FM dial. Abby, there's such a difference between people between an emergency shelter for people who are homeless and a transitional center and things like that. But listeners may not know that difference. Tell us about it.
Okay. Well, contemporary homelessness did not really become visible until the early 80s here in the country. And, I mean, we have a past president that was, well, maybe somewhat famous for saying, we do not have homelessness in this country.
Who's that?
That was Ronald Reagan.
Yes.
And he was saying this in the midst of people seeing it everywhere on the streets. And so it was very, you know, it showed the disconnect between the sort of ideology that he embodied and the reality of the situation. But in the 80s, there were a number of early activists that really pushed to get the numbers out there to say, we do have an epidemic here. And once they got those numbers established, they mobilized on a national level and got an act passed in 1985, I believe. So with that act, the government said, okay, we need to do something about this. We see the numbers. And that's when they started providing money for emergency shelters. So at that point, as much as they knew about homelessness was people are on the street, we need to get them off the street. And so an emergency shelter was often a cot and a hot meal to get people in off the street. Sometimes there'd be a drop-in center with that, just, you know, a daytime center. And so the government continued funding research through this whole time, trying to figure out why there were suddenly so many people who are homeless when, if I can put my own opinion out there,
please
well,
do.
We had a total disinvestment in public housing. And, you know, to suddenly disinvest in the one program that people who are low income or lower can live in, well, quite obviously that's a reason. But, you know, they funded a lot of research and it became clear to the government that emergency shelters were not enough, that they needed to put people in more structured programs. Now, those of us who agree or disagree with that, I mean, it's all over the map. But it was the idea that transitional programs were now what needed to be had. And transitional meant that you came in as, you know, experiencing homelessness. And at that point, you sit down with a case manager and you develop a plan to meet goals. And that might be employment or, you know, getting Social Security, could be a number of things. And that they then work with you to do that. And that if you are not working towards your plan, you may have to leave. So transitional centers, we're now seeing a new trend from the national government. They're saying that transitional programs, yes, these are helpful, but back to the original point, we really need housing. And so now we have this idea of permanent supportive housing, which is actually just permanent, meaning you don't have to leave ever, but supportive in that it has services attached to it that you might need. And, you know, these are done for all sorts of different populations, quote unquote. There might be mental health, could be job training, could be a lot of things. But they're recognizing that, you know, we don't really need to be putting people through all of these different programs. We need to get people into housing.
We're about halfway through our Keeping the Faith program this afternoon with our guest, Abby Harmon, who is a PhD student here at the University of Illinois and an activist as well as a scholar. And we'll be continuing our conversation with her in just a moment. Let me mention for listeners who some of our guests will be coming up here on Keeping the Faith. Next week, we'll be talking with Pastor Bob Rasmus about Lutheran social services throughout the state of Illinois. Bob is the pastor of St. Matthew's Lutheran Church in Urbana and also president of the Lutheran Social Services at this time. That'll be January 30th. First Sunday in February, we'll be playing an archive program we've had several requests for. Paul Nitter, his name is spelled K-N-I-T-T-E-R, from Union Theological Seminary, wrote a book that's had quite a bit of press nationally and even internationally called Buddhist. Well, the book's not called this, but it's about being Buddhist and Christian at the same time. I think the title, as I recall, was I Could Not Be a Christian Without Being a Buddhist. And that'll be an archive program played February 6th. On February 13, they will be talking about another book, I Shall Not Hate. February 20, I believe we have Professor Brent Houston talking about general situations of poverty in Champaign County from the Department of Media. Elizabeth Buckley will be our guest February 27th. We'll be talking about music. And Clayton Doffenbaugh on March 6th, talking about ecological issues. Those are some of the programs up ahead for Keeping the Faith. Again, my name is Steve Shoemaker, and this is Illinois Public Media, WILL 580 AM, and can be heard also at 90.9 FM, HD3 in Urbana, and online at WILL.illinois.edu. If you've missed part of this program or would like to hear previous programs, you can find them archived at that site. Again, that's will.illinois.edu. In the article in the News Gazette on January 16 about a place for families and homeless shelters, you were quoted, Abby, and this research, this learning that this class you have been teaching for now five different times, I think you've told me.
Yes, yeah.
With undergraduate students. The tone of voice that I heard in that quotation was that you were frustrated. What are some of the things that frustrate you about this whole issue?
Well, I could list for a while, but I think one of the things that frustrates me the most about homelessness and reactions to it and sort of policies around it is that there is not a lot of attention given to who the people are that are experiencing homelessness. It's, you know, as I've just talked about, the national government setting policy from emergency to transitional to permanent supportive housing. When you look at policy that's made on that scale, it really kind of misses the boat that each individual has become homeless for various reasons, and it might have things in common with other people, but that person is an individual, and they need to be dealt with as an individual and as an equal. That oftentimes programs get created, policies are made, and there's an idea that we are helping these other people. And that creates a real separation that I think it's very easy to forget that these folks that are experiencing homelessness are part of our community. Many, many people are raised within 10 miles of here or from surrounding communities, Danville, Decatur. These aren't that far away. But these are members of the community, and I think that's often forgot about. I mean, you'll see in the paper when people publicly comment, you know, letters to the editor, things like that. There's often talk of these people coming from somewhere else, and why are they coming here? And if we build shelters, people will come from elsewhere and take over our community. And I think that comes from not actually realizing who the people are who are experiencing homelessness.
You mentioned that people could listen to the February 23rd program, Start 6 at Night, the Homelessness Marathon, and hear actual voices of people locally who are homeless. But how else can ordinary people who are not homeless, who are fortunate enough to have a place to live, learn directly from people?
Well, I'll respond to that in the way that I talk to my students about it. Many of the students that come into the class have never talked to somebody who is experiencing homelessness. And one of the questions that I get asked right away is, what do you do when they ask you for money? Because this is often the only way that a lot of us will ever interact with somebody. And my answer to them is, it doesn't matter whatsoever if you give them money or not. What matters is that you look them in the eye and treat them like a human being. And, you know, your decision to give money, whatever. The point is that that is a human being. That person asking you for money is a human being. And first and foremost, that is the way that the interaction should be approached. So for people who have never talked to somebody who is homeless, I would say even more so than a volunteering situation, just encountering somebody on the street, you're probably going to have a more real conversation with somebody in that moment than you can in a lot of others. That would be my first advice.
Should people feel afraid to approach someone who seems to be living on the street?
I don't think so. I mean, in my opinion, most of the time your fears are far, far greater than anything that reality would hand you.
Let's see how that would work. I'm on the street. I look like I'm confused, poor. You approach me. What do you say?
In my experience, people will often ask you if they need something, if they need money, if they need directions. But being a friendly face very much helps them feel open to ask you what they, you know, about what they need. But if somebody looks lost, or if, you know, they have the visible signs of homelessness, a large backpack, you know, just sort of generally looking unkempt, I will ask if, you know, if they need something, if they just got to town, if they know where the services are in town, and point them in that direction. Also, another thing that's very helpful, a few years ago, I had a student do a really useful project, a mapping project. So he took all of the major social services in town, the shelters, the healthcare, all of this, and put them onto a map. It has their phone numbers, it has what they do, it has the bus lines that are close to them. And so I always keep a few of these in my bag. And if somebody is new to town, I can just hand them one. You know, we package them in these waterproof little packs so somebody can keep it on them, you know. And that's helped me out. It's helped other people out quite a few times.
Are you willing to share those maps?
Absolutely.
How could people contact you to get one?
My email address.
All right. You're willing to make that public?
I'm willing to make that public.
All right.
I think you can look it up on the site anyway. it's amille22@illinois.edu. And, you know, these are fairly available. I could also, you know, if I'm getting a lot of email contacts, I could put them up on the website for the class, you know, where it was first done.
All
and
right.
That would be, that would be on the East St. Louis Action Research Project website. But we'll see.
All right.
If we have emails.
Very good. We're talking with Abby Harmon about people who are homeless, and your first work on this in your master's program was on language. Now, when you mentioned that, that made me very nervous immediately because, you know, I haven't read your master's thesis, and I don't know what words are particularly harmful, dangerous, inappropriate. I've noticed that you've said people experiencing homelessness. I've noticed you saying people who are homeless. Why is that better than saying the homeless?
Well, I mean, obviously there are terms that people use that are far more detrimental than the homeless. But, I mean, I suppose for me, the term the homeless indicates that it's somehow a population that is set apart from the rest of the community, from the rest of the world even. And it also indicates that it's a group that can somehow be defined as all having something in common. Well, the only thing they have in common is that they're all unhoused. And so, you know, you could call them unhoused. But it's just the idea that as you use the same signifier, it becomes bigger than the word itself. It means something. Uh-huh. I mean, people were called hobos for a long time. And that means something in our society. I mean, people remember hobo culture from, you know, from early 1900s. I think in another 20 years, the homeless will mean something similar as well, that there will be some sort of culture around it. Hmm. And I want to reject the idea that people are in any way similar simply because they're poor and unhoused.
What kind of guidance do you get as a graduate student when you're doing a project like this that involves activism?
Guidance from other academics or...
Yeah.
Well, when I began my PhD program, I came to landscape architecture not because it was necessarily the best fit for me, but because there was a professor there that I really respected, and she respected what I wanted to do. I mean, the sort of work that I do is generally termed community-based research, where your research focus comes from needs in the community, and you seek to figure out how to make those better. And my advisor, Laura Lawson, who has since moved on to Rutgers University, but she did similar work, and it was around community gardening. Very different content,
sure,
but similar philosophy towards it. And so she has been nothing but supportive through this, knowing that it's often really hard to combine activism and scholarship because they're very separate for a lot of people. So she's been... Most importantly, emotionally supportive.
And did you find any barriers when you tried to do this kind of community-based research when you went to various agencies that were providing support for homeless people?
No, I think this community is fantastic. I mean, all of the service providers in this town are genuinely welcoming to anybody who wants to make something better or figure out, you know, the dimensions of homelessness, anything. They were incredibly welcoming. I mean, I've been going to the council service providers, to the homeless meetings for the last few years. And I mean, this group is just very open to looking at the issue differently or, you know, as much as possible.
Earlier last year, Shirley Stillinger was our guest on this program and talked about a homeless person that she had living in her garage and the experience he had with the legal system. What did you learn about how the law locally relates to people who are without a house?
Well, we ran into one of these situations with the tent community. City ordinances do not allow for tents or anything that does not fall under the term permanent structure to be anywhere within city limits. And mobile homes are a noted exception, and there are very particular areas in town that are zoned for those. Outside of that, semi-permanent structures really aren't possible. And that's one way, I mean, one very easy policy that you can point to say it is technically not allowed within city ordinance to be sleeping in a tent, but it would be allowed to be sleeping outside without a tent. Because the tent represents a structure.
I see.
And a structure that is not, that doesn't fall under building code. So that's one policy, you know, that...
doesn't seem to make any sense.
It doesn't make sense. For policymakers. But once the reality of the situation of being homeless and being on the street hits, it doesn't make a whole lot of sense for the person in the situation.
Right. And the tent, the Safe Haven tent community, when these 10 or 12 folks who could not be served by the existing shelters, transitional programs, maybe they needed shelter and they weren't able to be in the transition program for whatever reason or another, when you started that, You did find a home temporarily at the Catholic Worker House.
Yes.
But what happened there?
Well, that was the situation that I'm talking about with the city ordinances. The group was served a zoning violation, and what that said was essentially that the area was zoned for emergency or transitional shelters, which Catholic Worker House acted as, but that the tent structures did not fall under that because they weren't permanent structures. And so at that moment, we were given a deadline to be moved off of the site with fines of up to $750 a day to be leveraged after that point.
And where did the group go?
We went to St. Mary's Catholic Church. Father Tom Royer, who is such an amazing man, he took the group in out of a moral, ethical, religious belief that was his duty to do that. And, you know, he delivered a really impassioned homily, I believe the Sunday before the group moved over there, saying exactly that to his congregation, that this is our duty, and Jesus would not have turned this group away.
Father Tom Royer was also a previous guest here on Keeping the Faith. If you missed that program or would like to refer to it, you can again go to the archives, will.illinois.edu/keepingthefaith. Leave the G off the keeping, and you'll find that, or just go to AM and search for Tom Royer on the WILL search engine, and you'll find that program and can listen to it at your convenience via your computer. Again, that's will.illinois.edu/AM/keepingthefaith. What happened after St. Mary's congregation welcomed these homeless people in their tents in spite of the city ordinances?
Well, as you would expect, the city passed a zoning violation at that site as well and shortened the amount of time that we had to act on it before these fines would take place. So the group moved indoors there, and thank goodness there was a parish center there that served our purposes fairly well, actually very well, for the next few months. What happened after that was pretty incredible. Empty Tomb saw a connection that could be made in the community. Restoration Urban Ministries had around 15 hotel rooms that were no longer up to code, and so they couldn't use them to house the participants in their program. And Empty Tomb set about raising the money and the volunteers to upgrade these rooms with the understanding that if they did this, that Restoration would then house the Safe Haven tent community through the winter and into, I believe, May 1st was the final date there. And I just think that's such a fantastic example of a community coming together that really cares and is really thinking about how to make this happen. Because we were, I mean, our backs were against the wall. We could have stayed in that parish center, but it was a huge burden on the church.
We're down to our last 7 or 8 minutes, but we still have time for a call or two. 333-9455 is the local number in Champaign-Urbana. If it's long distance, toll-free 1-800-222-9455. Our guest is Abby Harmon, PhD student at the University of Illinois. Abby, when you look to the future, what do you hope for in terms of people who are homeless in this community and elsewhere?
That is a hard question to answer. Obviously, I hope that there are fewer people that have to experience homelessness or any sort of precarious housing situation. Without major community investment, though, that's not going to happen. And so I suppose in line with that, another thing that I would very much like to see happen is a community-wide commitment by the city and citizens alike that we're not going to tolerate the situation anymore. And that we are a fairly wealthy community, and we can do things to make it better.
Are there some people who are going to remain homeless regardless who are going to choose not to be involved in any program.
I think so, yes. And that is precisely why there are tent cities and tent communities around the country. Now, oftentimes tent cities will come about because it's a community where the need is so incredibly great that the shelters just can't come close.
Of course.
And those end up being tent cities of hundreds of people.
We have a caller with a question or comment on line one. Yes, you're on the air.
I find this very interesting where scholarship is helping people to find shelter. And I wonder if in the remaining time we could have some pointers about where a policy might be affected by citizens who want to help assure some kind of shelter for homeless people.
Thank you for the question.
Yeah. And
policies?
I'm not sure that I can give you a really great answer to that, but I can say that the place where citizens have the most impact on policy is local policy. National and state policy are pretty convoluted, and they go through a lot of bureaucratic channels. But local policy, and particularly in a community of our size, can be impacted by citizens coming together. I think, you know, educating yourself on the local situation is first and foremost. But after that, and I think the point where a lot of people stop is, you know, after education should come action. And that action can be done through city council meetings. I guess the one solid answer I can give you is local policy is the place to go.
Thank you very much for the question. Appreciate it. And again, we could probably sneak in another call or two, 333-9455 or 1-800-222-9455. There's a difference between dealing with Champaign and Urbana often in terms of homeless. Why is that?
Well, I mean, they're different cities under different city structure. I mean, one is a strong mayor system. The other is a city manager model. And, you know, those create differences. Beyond that, you know, Steve, you could probably answer that question better than I could. I've been in the community for 6 years, and so I'm a fairly newbie. My dissertation is looking at how both cities react to it. And, you know, I'm new. I couldn't really say.
And I was born here, and I have no idea. it would be another several programs to talk about some of those things. But it is fascinating to be in one city that has people walking across Wright Street and being treated differently depending on which side they are. And it's just a surprising thing to me.
Well, and back to the caller's question, you know, of how can we get involved in impacting policy. Policy is socially created. It is created by people. And I think that's what a lot of us forget living in a community is that all of the structures around us that tell us how to behave and what to do and what the city's going to give us, those are all made by people. And so people can change them. And I think political will is a huge issue. If individuals can come together with a plan, an actionable plan, then they can do it. And, you know, I don't know if that's the difference between the cities, but I know that over time I've seen what a few individuals with a really strong passion for something can get done. I mean, Homestead Apartments in Urbana is that very much.
It was accomplished over some obstacles, but it was accomplished. It made,
right.
made a huge difference in the lives of many people.
And by not that many people, but
that's
people
right.
who took the time to educate themselves and then act on it.
Right. How can a local person get involved? How many people does it take to form a committee that can make a difference?
Oh, I think three people. Two people pulling other people in, maybe.
We have a couple callers. Let's go to line number one real quick. Yes, you're on the air. Line one.
Hello?
Yes, you're on the air.
Okay. I work at the food pantry at Wesley United Methodist Church. Are you aware of the one that's open the third Thursday of every month?
Yes.
Okay. We could probably use some of those packets, and I didn't get your email down.
Okay. Yes.
The email again is?
amille22@illinois.edu.
Great. Okay. And that's to get the map showing where there are various services for people who are homeless. Thank you so much.
Okay. We do have a social service desk and hand out a lot of information, so that'll be helpful.
Fantastic. Okay.
Wonderful.
Okay,
thank you for the question. And we have another caller on line number two. Yes, go ahead.
Yes, good evening. I was wondering, what do you find mostly the reason for homelessness? Is it economic hardship, mental health, or maybe substance abuse? Thank you.
Thank you. Economic reasons, hands down. People cannot get jobs. Without a job, you can't get housing. If the government had more Section 8 vouchers, which is for subsidized housing, or more public housing, then people would not be homeless. At the end of the day, that's really what it's about.
There are also mental health issues, of course, and
there
substance
are.
Abuse.
But
that's
the primary
small.
Reason
yeah.
is that people are poor and can't make ends meet. Now, there can be all kinds of other things that stem out of that, the trauma of that poverty. Or things that, you know, combine with the poverty to make it worse. But at the end of the day, it is poverty.
Well, that's probably a good place for us to end today. And I want to thank our callers and thank our guest, Abby Harmon, for being on the program and talking about people who are experiencing homelessness. Abby is a PhD student here at the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign and has been doing research, but also has been an activist in the community. And among other things, she has helped start the Homelessness Marathon, which is a radio program.
Oh, I didn't help start it.
No, you didn't? You didn't.
No.
Someone else did that.
Yes.
Okay. You produced it for a while.
Yes.
Okay. But it's coming up on February 23rd. And, of course, WILL is one of the few radio programs that will advertise programs on other stations. And you may listen at FM, WEFT 90.1 on February 23rd, starting at 6 o'clock for 14 hours, hearing actual testimonies of people who are homeless. My name is Steve Shoemaker. I'm the usual host for these Keeping the Faith programs. And next week, I'm happy to be talking with Pastor Bob Rasmus about the Lutheran Social Services in the state of Illinois. Bob is pastor at St. Matthew's Lutheran Church on Philo Road in Urbana and chair of the state Lutheran Social Services group. On February 6th, we'll be playing an archive program with Professor Paul Nitter from Union Theological Seminary in New York about being Buddhist and Christian. And then we'll be talking about the book I Shall Not Hate on February 13. That will be on that Sunday night. February 20, we'll be talking about poverty in Champaign County, music on February 27, and March 6 about ecology with Clayton Doffenbaugh. These are some of the programs coming up on Keeping the Faith. Hope you can listen and perhaps give us a call and join the conversation. Thanks for listening to Keeping the Faith.
You've been listening to Keeping the Faith, the production of WILL AM 580. The opinions expressed on this program are solely those of the participants.
I've been a part of WILL Book Mentor Project for the last 2 years and read to my son's classroom for the last 2 years. Normally when I walk in, they all run to me and hug me. It's a feeling that I never had in my life. And the reason I'm doing this is because I want him to grow up and do the same thing when he has his own kids. My name is Shoni Coleman. WILL is my source for opportunities to interact with my son and other children.
Every month, 170 million Americans use public media. That's like everyone who lives west of the Mississippi.
Plus everyone in New York and Florida. More than half the country uses public media to be informed, engaged, and inspired. Now, public media needs your support.
Learn more about federal funding for public media at 170millionamericans.org.
This is Illinois Public Media, WILL 580 AM and 90.9 FM HD3, Urbana.